Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hot town, summer in the city. Back of my neck getting dirt and gritty. Bend down, isn't it a pity? Doesn't seem to be a shadow in the city.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. And with the air quality alert in effect as a result of the weather, let's talk about heat. And not all of us can stay in the air conditioning or in the shade. So we're going to explore how we respond to the heat physically, culturally, and emotionally. Maybe like Jack Nicholson in A Few Good Men.
I need an answer to my question, sir.
Take caution in your tone, Commander. I'm a fair guy, but this heat is making me absolutely crazy.
All right. That's Demi Moore and Jack Nicholson in that famous scene that we had to bleep. Let's start with Dr. Susie Vassallo, a clinical associate professor in the Department of Medicine at NYU Langone, who researches how the body controls its temperature. Welcome to WNYC, Dr. Vassallo.
Thank you.
And listeners, do you have a question about the medical side of heat and humidity? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And to start on the news, on the headline, what is this air quality alert in effect as a result of the weather? And why do we get these in the summer on the hottest days?
Well, the air quality in the ozone is affected by the temperature. And some people, particularly those with lung disease, such as asthma, are particularly affected by the air quality. And so we're warned to either take certain precautions, staying indoors, using our inhaler, doing something that's healthy for ourselves to avoid those potential
pitfalls. Use the word ozone. This is not the depletion of the ozone layer.
No. Well, and of course, that's a little bit out. The weatherman could probably tell us better about that. It's a little bit outside of my expertise. But we do understand that the weather and the heat and very much affect our health.
Do you want to walk us through the ways that the body is supposed to work to avoid overheating when the heat and humidity are high? We have bodily functions that are supposed to compensate, right?
That's right. So we have a thermostat in the brain called the hypothalamus. So we're supposed to keep a temperature of 98.6 degrees all the time. So our body's always working to do that. A couple of ways it does that. First of all, the thermostat is set at 98.6. If it starts to feel like the body's heating up, it sends signals out to the arms and the legs and the body to dilate the blood vessels so that they expand, bring more blood to the surface where the skin is, and then we are sweating and it's bringing more and more blood to the surface, and we're having evaporative cooling by sweating. And of course, all of that requires a really good heart. The heart goes from pumping about 5 liters per minute of blood around the body to up to 15 liters per minute.
Oh, the heart works harder in hot weather.
That's right. And that's really critical, so that people who have a heart disease or high blood pressure, there's some reason their heart can't work as well, are going to be at risk of heat-related problems.
At what temperatures do you start to see the cases of heat exhaustion or heat stroke or other actual heat-related emergencies in emergency rooms?
Well, we see those. It's the heat index, which of course is a combination of the humidity and the temperature. And the National Weather Service has that beautiful chart with orange and yellow and green and red for danger. And so we start to see in the 80s, particularly in New York City, we start to see around 86, 88 degrees.
But that's supposed to be our high today is about 88.
Yes.
And then about 90 tomorrow.
That's right. And, of course, it depends on the person's health and their ability to have some degree of time every day in air conditioning. That relieves some of the heat stress. So there are a lot of things that are happening. But somebody who's on certain drugs that put them at risk or using drugs or who's actually taking some pharmaceutical treatments, those people are also at risk. But anybody exercising hard, even young and healthy, like military, can succumb to heat stroke given the right set of circumstances.
You mentioned air conditioning. Is part of the advantage of air conditioning that it serves as a dehumidifier?
It is. That's true. And that's because the humidity has so much to do with this. It's a dehumidifier. It conditions the air in that way. And, of course, it cools.
What happens in somewhere like Arizona where it can be 120 degrees but with very low humidity and people don't even feel themselves sweat because the sweat evaporates so quickly.
Well, I think a lot of people in those temperatures and even without the humidity get heat stroke. And, of course, it's very they have everybody's air conditioned there, so that gives them the – and they're also behaviorally, they know to stay outside or stay indoors at certain times of day. And but plenty of people get sick in those circumstances as well.
What's the difference between heat stroke and heat exhaustion?
So heat stroke means that your ability to think clearly is altered. You are in delirium or you're not thinking clearly, whereas heat exhaustion
I know people who have heat stroke all winter by that definition.
Right, right,
no, I'm
right.
kidding.
So heat exhaustion is usually with a completely clear thinking. Usually the body temperature stays approximately normal, whereas at heat stroke, the body's temperature is above 105 degrees.
Whoa, that's high.
It is.
Listeners, do you have a question about the medical side of overheating? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692 for Dr. Susie Vassallo from the NYU Langone Medical Center, 212-433-9692. You mentioned medications that can exacerbate the way your body deals with heat. I want everybody to know that you're cited in the AP article about the death of the Rikers Island inmate from overheating in his cell because you monitor heat conditions there. What's your association with Rikers Island?
Well, I'm the expert agreed on by the city and by legal aid to look at the conditions at Rikers with regards to the temperatures and to try to help assess the risk of the prisoners at Rikers with regards to heat illness.
So in that case, you noted, according to the AP, that it's likely the drugs he was taking for his mental illness exacerbated the effects of the heat in his cell. Can you get specific about that?
Right. So if you think of us as human beings having a couple of things that we do, number one, we have a thermostat in our brain, and that the drugs that people take to treat mental illness will affect the function of that thermostat. As well, it affects the ability of the sweat glands to work, and it often will. Some of those medications can affect the ability of the to sweat. So, in addition, you have the underlying mental illness, which impairs people's thought process sometimes, their realization that they're getting sick, their ability to deal and to ask for help in a way that's going to result in help.
What other common medications exacerbate the effects of heat?
Well, probably the most well-known are those that treat high blood pressure. Some of those keep the heart from pumping as hard as it needs to be pumping or as beating as many times. So beta blockers, calcium channel blockers, all those things that people take, particularly diuretics. A common one would be HCTZ, like hydrochlorothiazide, because those are deplete the body of fluids and dehydration can result. And you need to be able to pump a large amount of blood around the system, and you need to have a healthy heart. So diabetes as well, that ability to dilate the blood vessels is impaired in people with diabetes because diabetes affects the vasculature.
Listeners, your questions about the medical side of overheating for Dr. Susie Vassallo from NYU Langone, 212-433-WNYC. And Matt in Springfield, you're on WNYC. Hello, Matt.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was calling. I have multiple sclerosis, and I know that my nerves are kind of frayed, so that changes the equation for me. I tend to overheat, and it affects my nerve conduction. And I wondered if you had any word on why it is that heat would so strongly affect heat and humidity actually would affect my nerve conduction.
Well, that's a good question. All of the processes that I've talked about, from the brain to the arms and legs and to the sweat glands and to the blood vessels, will be somewhat affected in multiple sclerosis. You may also be on some medicine to treat that, which are also affecting the ability of your body to lose heat to the outside to properly cool itself.
Brenda in Patterson, you're on WNYC. Hi, Brenda.
Hi, how are you?
Okay, thank you.
Good. My question is, I have high blood pressure, and I also had a hysterectomy. Now, with the hysterectomy, it automatically put me through the hot flashes. With this weather, it's not helping any. I get the hot flash severe where I wear glasses. They will actually steam up. I don't know what else to do. I can't take any other medications because I am a recovering cancer patient also.
Any advice for Brenda?
Well, I think the most important thing is to avoid those things. You are limited in your ability to treat yourself because of the reasons you've said. And some of those things will get better over time, but the main thing is to recognize that you have that limitation and to keep yourself out of dangerous situations.
Brenda, good luck. Are children better able to cope than adults?
Well, they have children have better hearts in general. They can make faster heart rates, but we have to be very careful. There are a number of children that die in the United States every year who are locked in cars in hot environments, and the temperature can rise over 5 or 10 minutes to lethal levels, and that goes for pets as well. So the answer is they have good hearts, but otherwise, and they do better than elderly people.
And yet, older people also tend to feel colder and like heat. Tell me if I'm generalizing incorrectly here, you know, and move to Florida because it's a more comfortable climate than dealing with the cold, which gets harder as you get older.
That's true. It's actually they did a lot of studies in England in the 1950s that showed that people didn't even recognize the temperatures, their body temperatures. So we become a little bit it's more difficult for us to regulate our temperature, either cold or hot, the older we get. Another pleasure of aging.
Related question, I think. Jan in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jan.
Hi. I love saunas. They've helped me so much over the years. And, I'm in my 70s, and my girlfriend just told me, she says, older people were told not to take saunas, and I was wondering why.
Well, if you think about it, the way that we cool ourselves is by sweat is evaporating, but, of course, a sauna is all water, so you cannot evaporatively cool. So if you love saunas, I would continue to do what you love. Be very aware. If you start to feel hot, get out of the sauna, cool off a little bit, and then go back in. Don't stay in for a prolonged period and pay good attention to your body.
Saunas can be humid heat or they can be dry heat either, right?
That's true.
Is one or the other better, especially for an elderly person?
Well, I really don't think so because both of them can result in heat illness. And when I'm in a sauna, usually you're happy to be there. It's a fun experience, and you need to pay careful attention. When you start to feel warm or hot, just get out and use common sense and enjoy yourself.
Joe in Harrington Park, you're on WNYC. Hi, Joe.
Yes, hi. I noticed, I'd like to ask, when I play tennis, sometimes too hot out, I get goosebumps, and then I start feeling a little bit lightheaded. Is that another symptom of heat exhaustion?
It is. It's one of the most common problems with you start to feel goosebumps and you feel almost like you're shivering. And exactly why that is probably just adrenaline stimulation, and it's a very good warning.
Bob in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Bob.
Hi there. You know, I was in 2000, I was on the Great Wall of China hiking up, and it was 100 degrees and 98% humidity, and I stopped to help another person in trouble and ended up with a terrible situation myself. A good Samaritan saved me. But my question, and so I realize now how important all this is, but my question is about electrolytes, pre-treating yourself with electrolytes, the importance of electrolytes, how much, when, and so on, to help yourself when you're going to be in a hot climate situation and exerting yourself.
The most important thing is just to drink enough water and not necessarily those drinks that come with electrolytes, such as sports drinks. A lot of them have a lot of sugar, and that's not helpful. And no salt tablets. If you think about how you feel when you eat a bag of pretzels, you need to drink a lot of water because so that balance between salt and water is important, and the best thing is just drinking water and maybe a little bit more than thirst. Thirst is a good indicator of how much water, but usually a little bit more than thirst, especially the older we get. We tend not to feel as thirsty and we need to drink a little bit more than thirst, but not too much. Like the marathoners, sometimes they drink a whole lot of water, and their salt electrolyte falls too low, and that creates another emergency.
Did you say a little salt with the water? Rather than resort to the Gatorade for the electrolytes, because of the sugar and everything, but a little bit of salt with the water?
No, I want to be more clear. That is, just regular water is fine. That's all you need. You don't. You shouldn't take extra salt.
Salt tablets? Some
no,
people have taken?
No, that's a definite no.
No, because it...
Because basically you have you're too much salt, and you need to be always at a constant equilibrium of salt and water, and just drinking water, your kidneys will do the rest.
We're just about out of time. Anything really important that we didn't get to that affects a lot of people?
I think that the most important thing would be the public health message, which is that there are always extra deaths on heat waves a couple of days in front of above a 90 or like today. Really pay attention to your neighbors. A lot of people won't use air conditioning. It's expensive. Fans don't help. So really pay attention to those infirm or on medications, or your neighbors, and check on them and bring them into air conditioning at least a few hours a day.
And with the ozone pollution alert in effect today, if you want to work out, better to go to the air-conditioned gym than to take your usual run outside, if that's what you do?
Well, I find the air conditioning very pleasant.
Pleasant. And also
but I'm not,
protective.
I'm not sure. It is protective, but I think that for most healthy people without asthma and all these other – a run outside is perfectly healthy.
Dr. Susie Vassallo, Clinical Associate Professor in the Department of Medicine at NYU Langone on the medical side of heat. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Oh!
Talking about heat on The Brian Lehrer Show. And we continue now by opening up the phones for your calls on cultures of heat. You know there are places where dealing with heat is a way of life. Call in now if you are from one of those places and tell us your story of living in the tropics or the south or deserts anywhere in the world and how those cultures embrace or cope with the higher temperatures. 212-433-WNYC for your calls on your experiences with the culture of heat. 212-433-9692. Tell us your story of living with heat anywhere in the world. Any Texans out there? Anyone from Brazil or New Delhi or Central Africa? Call in and tell us about your culture of heat in Phoenix and Tempe, in Mexico, or anywhere. 212-433-9692. What are the houses like? What are the apartments like? How do you structure your day? What is the culture of heat where you came from? 212-433-9692. We've been collecting these on Facebook. Carolita posted, in Madrid, I noticed one old building I lived in was built around an atrium, which naturally kept the apartment pretty airy and relatively cool compared to outside. Good architecture. That was Carolita posting on Facebook. Larry wrote, in Alabama, most homes have porches, be they open and covered in rockers or screened and awash in the slow squeak of the chairs on the swing. They were all fragrant, he writes, with the fresh mown grass and abuzz with the great even... I guess that's what they say in the evening. That's how we wrote it. Even as the neighbors stroll by. Sounds beautiful, Larry. Thank you for posting that. What do you remember about the food or the architecture or the lifestyle of the really hot culture that you came from? 212-433-WNYC. And what can we learn for these relatively few days in New York when it feels like home here? 212-433-9692. We'll take those calls in a minute. Talking about heat on The Brian Lehrer Show and now taking your calls on the cultures of heat that you came from. 212-433-WNYC. And Baba in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hey, Baba.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Where are you from originally?
Nigeria.
How hot would it get in Nigeria?
Oh, the hotness with the humidity. Oh, about 90, 100, sometimes 102 degrees.
And so you moved to New York What'd you bring with you? How do you compare?
Yeah, I moved to New York, and the experience is, after staying in New York for some time, if you went to Nigeria, like, on vacation or just visiting, you start experiencing the uncomfortable heat or heat right from the airport. And it could be so unbearable for the first 1 week, like, why did I come here? I see we didn't come from there in the first instance. And, you know, a lot of us will complain, like, how do you people cope? So, they, like, the doctor that came on the program was explaining earlier on, it seems like our body is kind of built to regulate itself, because you find out that after 1 week or two, you adjust and you feel like, oh, you've been here forever.
So you adjust. Your bodies adjust. Our bodies adjust. But what about cultural adaptations? Anything that you did as a matter of course in the part of Nigeria that you came from that you don't see here?
Well, I mean, the in spite of the heat or how hot it becomes, you can never find a woman going almost half naked. As they would, within the 3 months, it will be in New York. You know, like, people would just, like, want to throw out their clothing and walk on the street almost half naked. No, a woman would not do that on the street of Lagos.
Out of modesty or out of a way to keep cool?
Out of modesty, out of respect for their body, out of the fact that, no, you can't, you know, I can't walk on the street like that.
Baba, thank you very much. But I think we're going to hear kind of the opposite, and for a different reason, from Roy in Greenwich Village, originally from Brazil. Right, Roy?
Yes. Well, I've lived there with my family. But no, I wouldn't say so much the opposite. But what I do know, and I'm sure anyone who's read or dealt with history would bear witness to, is in the cultures that has traditionally been known to deal with hot weather, very rarely have you seen them taking it off. If, to the contrary, they put on more, you know, turbans on the head to avoid the sunstroke. You know, the sun doesn't hit the body as quick when you're buffering it with certain colors that will reflect it and thereby bring in an air-conditioned sort of situation. And for that reason, when I was in Brazil, for the most part, and my family members was like, why do you have on all those clothes? Well, hello, the sun doesn't hit my body as quick, and I don't get hot as quick, you know. But we have been led to believe that, to the contrary, you take off everything and you stay warmer. But history would bear me witness that it's just the opposite.
Wow. Seems counterintuitive, right?
Well, it is. When you think about it, I mean, common sense would tell you, you know, it even has shown historically that our hair has developed this spongy look or matted look for the same purpose, to hold the water, and in turn, a breeze come by, and you got a air condition. Where if your hair was stringy, then you'll be profusely sweating. So everything is adaptation, as you forementioned. But we in New York and places like this, we have a tendency to think, take off more and you'll be cooler. To the contrary, you'll get skin cancer, God knows what else, if you don't buffer it with. And they use certain colors in Africa that reflects the sun. You know, of course, they're not going to put on black in some nations, but they'll put on certain colors. Then these colors will in turn serve as a buffer for the sun, and in turn, the body stays cooler.
Roy, thank you so much. And let's go to Kelly in Freeport, originally from Phoenix. Kelly, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. I hear you have a weather report from back home.
Oh, yeah. Hot, hot, hot. It's probably about 110 going on for weeks now there. They get a random break here, you know, every other day for a couple weeks. It might cool down, but no, it's really hot. And I loved your question about what did it look like, because it's beige. It's all beige and bleached out.
Because it's desert?
Desert, yes. I mean, and for whatever reason, when they built the city up, they thought that natural color would look nice. And it, literally, you fly over into Phoenix, Arizona, and you see the mountains, and you see beige, and you see blue specks, which are swimming pools.
And besides the swimming pools, how else do people in Phoenix adapt differently from here?
Air conditioning. Everybody hides. There is no, you know, as the years have gone on, when I was growing up there, I left 20 years ago, but it was 98 degrees was the average, 98 to like maybe 104. And now that's up to, you know, to upwards of 110. And adaptation is living life around the heat, you know. You live inside for those months and you kind of hide out and you
go out early in the morning and you stay in most of the day, and you go out late at night if you're doing something else, nightlife, and it's tough.
Kelly from the beige-colored world of southern Arizona. Shanti in Jersey City, you're on WNYC. Hi, Shanti.
Hi, Brian. I just wanted to echo your caller from Phoenix. When I was growing up in India, living in India in the mid-80s, of course, avoidance was a big tactic, so you'd stay inside in the afternoon in the hottest parts of the day. And then our house, you know, the windows are all open. There was no glass. It was just, you know, iron bars, really. So the windows were all open. And what we would do is hang shades made of sort of wicker mesh on the outside of the windows. And then in the hottest part of the day, we would lower all of them and drench them in water, which was also kind of at a premium because there was a drought at the time. But we would drench them in water, and then the breeze coming in from outside would sort of be naturally cooled to create a natural air cooling system.
But it's humid, not dry there, right?
Well, I was living in Hyderabad, so it was dry, actually.
Shanti, thank you. And Ketley in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Ketley.
Hi, Brian. I wanted to just say that I'm from Haiti, and in Haiti, just around 12 o'clock, the streets empty out, everybody's back in the house, taking a siesta, having lunch, and taking a nap up until about 3. And I remember being in school and having to go home from school and take a shower, get my lunch, well, actually dinner, and sleep for a little bit and go back to school. Cool off on the heat. We let the hot sun of 12 o'clock go by first, and then we go back out.
So even the school day, not just the work day, is bifurcated to take a break from the heat.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We didn't go back to school until after, say, 2 o'clock, and we stayed till about 5. And that was how the break of our day.
But how can they give them 6 hours of homework like they do in this country on that schedule?
Brian? The kids are really, really, really focused on work. We memorize everything. They're really focused on work. I'm a school teacher here anyway. And the kids in Haiti, they really appreciate a good education. Not that they don't hear, but parents are very serious about it because they pay for it.
Ketley, thank you very much for your call. Thanks to all of you from your calls describing the heat in all kinds of places, and you all can keep it going on Facebook. Like us while you're there to share your stories of living in cultures of heat. Facebook.com/Brian Lehrer, WNYC. We're talking about heat on the Brian Lehrer Show. And remember those cold winter days when we daydreamed about being warmed by the summer sun? Well, now that it's July, we don't have to pine for warm weather. But not everyone is so lucky. You know the movie Frozen, where the main characters meet a snowman who, like many of us, craves a little bit of heat?
Summer?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I don't know why, but I've always loved the idea of summer and sun and all things hot.
Really? I'm guessing you don't have much experience with heat.
Nope.
Nope. We might all be having a little more experience with heat if climate change continues to develop as scientists expect. A lot more experience, in fact. Our lifestyles could be about to change immensely in the coming years to deal with climate change in our daily lives and perhaps more to resemble some of the things that we heard from our callers from elsewhere in the world. More air conditioners, cooler architecture, even moving out of your house because it's underwater, or restructuring our work and our school days. David Biello is editor for Environment and Energy at Scientific American. He's writing a book about living in a new geologic era due to climate change, so he has spent a lot of time thinking about these things. David, welcome to WNYC.
Thanks for having me. My kids would be psyched that you got frozen in there.
Right. And you wrote an article in Scientific American about how ants could help global warming cry uncle. Let me just start there.
Well, I wasn't expecting that question, but yes. So the latest science shows that ants speed up the natural weathering of rock. Rock is actually how CO2 gets out of the atmosphere naturally. And ants speed that process up by, it seems, breaking up the rock. So, have a little love for ants.
And do I see correctly that Your Twitter bio is simply the H.G. Wells quote that history is a race between education and catastrophe.
Right, exactly. And we're definitely in that race right now, and we will be for the rest of this century.
He must have been referring to things before global warming, right?
I think so. Although, you know, I mean, if you look at what he thought about Mars, he definitely thought the analog of global warming was responsible for what was going on there.
Huh. And you're working on a book about the Anthropocene.
Yes, there's some debate.
Want to make that our vocabulary word for the day?
Sure, why not? There's a lot of debate about how to pronounce that. But essentially...
Correct me.
Well, it's Anthropocene. Or if you're British, Anthropocene. So those are the three contenders. But essentially, it's this idea that we have entered a new geologic era because human impacts have grown so large that, you know, whether it's climate change or moving kind of rocks, we move more sediment than rivers these days. So our impact on the planet will be visible in the rock record for thousands, millions of years. And it's only a question of how long that impact will last.
Anthropology is the study of human cultures.
Yes,
so
exactly.
The Anthropocene would be the age of human impact.
Correct, correct. And it would be the first geologic era named after a species. We're pretty anthropocentric, so that makes a lot of sense.
So as we might say, the Pleistocene era or the Stone Age, today we live in the Anthropocene age.
That is the argument, exactly.
Or do we already, or might we enter it?
The argument is that we have already entered it. It's just a question of when. Some people argue that it happened actually a very long time ago when we started farming, so about 10,000 years ago. Some people argue that it's a lot more recent, say, with the dawn of the nuclear era. But I would say the consensus is that it probably started right around the time we invented industrialization and started doing climate change.
So listeners, obviously people in our area have already started to adapt in your personal lives, in some cases because of Sandy. How else are you starting to adapt for the climate future? 212-433-WNYC. How do you see it in your life? 212-433-9692 for our guest David Biello from Scientific American, as we imagine our heat culture of the future in the climate change Anthropocene era. Let's go through a few different parts of just the United States. Mm-hmm. What do you think will happen to Miami?
So the big prediction for Miami is a lot more water, right? Sea level rise. We're already up about a foot since the 19th century. Yeah, about 10 inches. And it's particularly bad along the East Coast, actually. We're one of the global centers of sea level rise because of...
You mean the whole eastern seaboard of the United States?
Correct, correct. We actually are experiencing some of the largest sea level rise in the entire world.
How does New York City compare to Miami in that respect?
We're pretty similar. We're very similar.
A foot. That's
yeah.
A lot.
Fortunately for us, we have slightly better geology. So Miami is sitting on some former limestone, and it's about 4 feet above current sea level. We're a little bit higher, unless you're in Battery Park City.
So what do the computer models tell us it'll be like 50 years from now?
So Miami's going to be even hotter. It will be even more tropical city. We're looking at potentially as much as 2 feet more by 2060 of sea level rise. 2 feet more would get you about halfway to where Miami sits presently. So they're going to need to do something pretty drastic if they want to keep that water out and keep Miami viable. The biggest impact isn't going to be like flooded homes and things of that nature, because that will come with hurricanes. It's going to be the loss of fresh water. As the seawater comes in underground, it's going to get rid of kind of the fresh water supply. And so where does Miami get its water then?
And New York City in 50 years?
New York City is going to be a lot hotter. We've already seen some of that. I think we might follow the Japanese and start walking around in shirt sleeves rather than the business suits we seem to fetishize currently.
What do they do in Japan?
So in Japan, because essentially they had the Fukushima disaster and had to cut back on electricity use, the thought was, why are we walking around in these business suits in the middle of summer when it's extremely hot? Let's walk around in short sleeves. We'll be cooler. We won't have to run the AC so much. And they did that, and they were able to save a ton of electricity and essentially survive the loss of nuclear power in that country.
So not just casual Fridays, but casual June, July, and August.
Exactly. Casual summers, which sounds great.
So let's go to another part of the country, The Dakotas.
Yes. So the Dakotas are changing actually quite rapidly. If you think about it, over the course of one farmer's lifetime, we've gone from kind of horse-drawn agriculture to this satellite-guided precision agriculture where essentially they're almost leaving it up to the robots to farm. And they've switched from wheat to corn and soy. And that's part of the kind of general shift to hotter, drier conditions in the Great Plains, the breadbasket of the United States. Places like Kansas aren't going to be the agricultural hotbeds that they are now. The Dakotas are going to be more of that kind of locus.
So will it be better in North Dakota when it gets warmer?
You know, it might be better in North Dakota when it gets warmer, and it's going to be better for farmers. The only problem is they'll probably lose their jobs to those drones that I mentioned.
Is there an argument to be made that it's a zero-sum game? In other words, whatever some cities lose, or not just cities but areas, by becoming too hot, other places like the Dakotas and Canada will gain, and it's a net wash for humanity as a whole?
There are definitely winners and losers. I don't know that it's a net wash for humanity. Climate change, most of us live in kind of the more temperate regions. We're not living in Siberia or northern Canada. Those places, yes, are going to get a little bit warmer, a little more amenable to human life. But the problem is that places like Miami are going to become a lot less amenable to human life as we know it.
We'll just have to move this whole operation and set up New Siberia Public Radio.
That's right.
Dan in the Hudson Valley, you're on WNYC. Hello, Dan.
Hi. The thing that my wife and I did is we bought a house that is 500 feet over sea level so our kids have somewhere to live. I'll take my answer off the air.
That's a very good idea. I don't think we're going to see 500 feet, so you should be pretty well high and dry.
Joe Ginder in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Yeah, hi, Ron. How are you?
Okay.
I grew up in India, in North India, near Delhi, and I'm a farmer, and now I'm a cab driver in New York City. And I was talking to the girl, you know, and you just have the guy over there who telling about we're creating more systemically, you know, like look in Manhattan, how many glasses building and all that. It creates more warm weather in the city, you know. And we also have a food, which is the food is not a, we have a food, this is not a, actually made for our body. All this prestige, you know, all this things we're eating also create in our body, which is not made for the human. And all that kind of things also create our fabrication. The clothes are not made for this human life because we are made by five elements. We are going away from that.
In the hot climate that you came from in India, did people cover their bodies? We heard from some of our caller who had lived in Brazil, for example, and in Africa, that people cover their bodies. They don't just go in shorts and tank tops to deal with the heat.
They cover the body when they're really hot, and they stay in the shadow under the tree or somewhere, you know, like. And
Joe Ginder, thank you very much.
Shade is really important, and kind of loose-fitting long clothing is a great way to adapt to the heat. But he's right that our clothes and our kind of buildings are not built with a hotter climate in mind.
How about New York-style skyscrapers? He mentioned the glass buildings. You would think glass lets in a lot of heat, as opposed to, I don't know, a brick building that just has smaller windows.
That's exactly right. This is why we have greenhouses. Lets the infrared in, doesn't let it back out again. And that's why we have to run those air conditioners so full blast that people are walking around in sweaters inside, even when it's, 100 degrees outside.
Paul in Jersey City, you're on WNYC. Hi, Paul.
Yes, hi. I'm wondering if the climate change can be blamed for the rise in number of sinkholes in the state of Florida.
Aha, sinkholes. I was in Tampa for a few days last year, and that was the big story there. A few sinkholes had opened up out of nowhere, it seemed, and swallowed people up, seriously.
Yeah.
And people were all paranoid about the sinkholes.
Florida is known for sinkholes. That's a feature of limestone geology. I'm not sure that there's a link directly to climate change, but it certainly has to do with water meeting limestone, kind of eating away at it from underneath, and then the sinkhole forms. So potentially as those sea levels rise and maybe water levels, the water table underneath the land kind of comes up, then you might have more sinkholes.
So in this 50-year outlook, will people stop moving to Florida for the warm weather and just move to Maryland or Delaware?
I think so. I mean, certainly those places will have similar heat and maybe a little bit less of the climate chaos that that Florida can expect from hurricanes and the like.
And as we go out, this conversation has been about the 50-year heat forecast and how people would have to adapt if we keep going down this road, not about a policy debate. But is there anything that you particularly favor to stave off the worst?
Well, I mean, we're starting to finally make some moves to restrain our greenhouse gas emissions. The Obama administration has those new carbon limits. We're going to need to go a lot further, and we might even need things like the ants to save us. So we should really kind of encourage all those potential solutions, anything to get kind of the CO2 back down again.
David Biello writes about energy and the environment for Scientific American and has a book coming about the Anthropocene age in which we are now living. Thank you.
Thank you.
School is out and it's sort of a buzz. But back then I didn't really know what it was. But now I see what happened is the way that people respond to summer madness. The weather is hot and girls are dressing less and checking out the fellas to tell them who's best.
Riding We're talking about heat on the Brian Lehrer Show. More to come. We're talking about heat on the Brian Lehrer Show today. By the way, special shout out to Eric on Twitter, who tweets a unified title for today's heat special, How I Stop Worrying and Learn to Love the Bomb, B-A-L-M, Know Your Cultural History. So far in today's conversation about heat, we've been very practical. What does heat do to your body? What will be the effect of climate change on our cultures? So we end with a bit of a philosophical question. How do you represent heat on camera? As abstract as that question sounds, we actually have someone here who has answers and some things to show us. James Estrin is longtime New York Times photographer at home and abroad and co-founder of their Brilliant Lens blog. He has picked some of his favorite photos that represent heat and is here to talk about the challenges that come along with capturing heat and being a photographer in scorching conditions. Jim, welcome back to the show. Thanks for doing another one of these photography on the radio segments with us.
Thanks, Brian. Happy to be here.
And listeners, as we've been saying, you'll want to go to our website right now and follow along so you can see the photos as we discuss them. We have heat-related imagery on our webpage. Go to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show if you want to follow along as we talk to James Estrin. And don't worry, we will also describe them for those of you just listening. But if you're near a computer or phone, go to WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show, find the slideshow, and follow along visually. Jim, before we talk about a specific photo to give people time to get there, I want to talk about some of the challenges that come from trying to capture heat in a photo. In general, you told us that weather photos are the bread and butter of news photography, but that means it's really easy to just find yourself taking the same photo over and over. So how do you keep things fresh?
Well, that really is a challenge, particularly after 30 years of doing this on the streets of New York. You just pass up the photos you've taken before. You look for different ways of representing heat, of showing the effect on people.
And people is the key?
Yeah, absolutely. The heat without people isn't really a photograph unless you go for cooking an egg on a hot sidewalk.
Can you really do that? Have you ever photographed anyone doing that or trying and failing?
I fortunately have not done that, but I've seen other people's photos of it, and I saw one particularly sad attempt by someone who'll go nameless who did it in a frying pan, which does not work, by the way, on a hot sidewalk.
If you do it right on the sidewalk, the five-second rule does not apply, right?
I've never heard of anyone who ate one.
Let's talk about the photo at the top of our page. And for those of you following along, a version of the classic cooling off outdoors photo. But this is a wading pool set up on the sidewalk on 134th Street in the Bronx. One of the cool things about this photo is that there's everyone, young and old, taking part. And I guess when it's hot out, it doesn't matter if you're 5 or if you're 85. If there's a wading pool, you're going to jump in it. Want to talk about why you like this photo?
Yeah, it's actually one of my favorites. This was a day, I think it was like the second or third day of 100-degree heat in New York. And I'm driving around trying to show the effect and the difficulty and how people are coping. And so one of the places I really like to go is the South Bronx. There's more people on the street and less people inside in the air conditioning. And I was just driving by, saw the pool on the sidewalk, and you had this great moment of serendipity where you look up and say, thank you, and just got out and took the picture. I drove by there recently, and it looks pretty much the same.
1999, really hot year. How do you photograph July 2014 to represent, you know, it actually hasn't been that hot this year?
Well, there are certain tricks of making things look a little hotter or a little cooler than they are. So often you'll get an assignment and saying, well, it's the hottest, you know, it's hot early in the year. So it's March, but it's maybe 68 degrees. So to find people who look hot, you look for young people. They're more likely to take their shirt off. To find people who look cold when it's not that cold, you look for old people in the park. When it's 85 degrees, they'll have a winter coat on. And when it's 60 degrees, there'll be someone in Washington Square Park without a shirt on.
Absolutely. And are kid photo subjects becoming harder to find because they're inside playing video games rather than getting out on the street and adapting in the ways you just described?
Oh, yeah. It's actually much more difficult to take good street photos in New York, good slice-of-life photos. There's fewer people on the street, living on the street, and the ones that are on the street are on their iPhone. So, you know, 20 years ago, there were just a lot more children on the street in the summer, and now there's many fewer.
And listeners, again, and if you're just joining us, if you want to follow along and look at some of these heat photos taken by lens blogger James Estrin of the New York Times. Follow along on our webpage as we discuss some of these images. Go to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. It's that easy. WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Join a lot of people there looking at these photos. Next photo is from the 2003 blackout inside a building where a woman was helping her elderly neighbor up the stairs. And do I gather you took this in total darkness?
Almost total darkness. There was windows at the end of the stairs, so that's why there's some light there. But but the stairs overall were dark. And
I see her holding. I see the woman holding a flashlight.
Yes. Well, she was helping this old man up the stairs, and there's, you know, there's no electricity, means there's no elevators, and so he had to walk up. I think it was 14 flights of stairs to get to his apartment. I mean, after, you know, at first when you go out and do hot weather, you're looking for how people are coping. But by the third day of a major heat wave, it starts having a news story, the bad effects that heat are having on people, on their health. And it's not uncommon to have outages, and people in public housing suffer greatly, particularly older people, and without air conditioning.
And the caption refers to Plinio Rodriguez, 80, getting assistance, walking up to his 12th-floor apartment from Sandra Gonzalez, who was visiting a friend, and that was, 11 years ago. He looks a little freaked out, actually walking up those steps. And we hear those pleas from officials during blackouts to check on your elderly neighbors. So is the journalistic context here that you set out to take a photo that put a story or an image to that phenomenon?
Yes, I was looking for, you know, the lights were out. I went to these projects, and you know, what is the news? The news is people actually suffering, and sometimes people even dying. you know, in their hot apartments without air conditioning. And
they say heat waves are the most deadly form of weather emergency. We may think of it as more like hurricanes and tornadoes and things like that, but numerically it's heat waves.
It is, and people are less alarmed about it and pay less attention to it.
Let's talk about the next two photos, which I guess we can describe as how to make fans interesting. Want to describe these fans?
Yes. Well, this is the giant 30-foot fan. Well, they're two separate photos. And if you don't have air conditioning, fans are critical. So, again, looking at what is the news effect of heat, after a few days, I went to an emergency room, I believe at Maimonides Hospital.
Right.
I got permission to go in. And their emergency room was completely overcrowded with people, you know, suffering from the heat, people in heat stroke, people who are dehydrated. And it's a way of emphasizing the fan. So I'm a little closer to the fan so you see it.
Right. And, of course, the context of this is anything but funny. As you say, it's the Maimonides Hospital emergency room, and you can see two people in the shot. The main one identified there as Nina Messina being treated for heat exhaustion after she fainted in her son's arms while walking on the street, and she's in a bed, and it looks like she's got a wet cloth of some kind that she's putting on her forehead. But you're taking this from behind this giant fan, which takes up about 60% of the shot. So you're really getting a sense of how a fan is used in a hospital emergency room. Did they not have air conditioning?
Not really. It was pretty hot. I don't remember if there was air conditioning or not, but I remember it was quite hot there, quite warm. And in the second photo, they were giving out fans to elderly people on the Upper East Side. And this is a woman reacting with great pleasure the first time turning on the fan in her apartment. She had been in her apartment without a fan for several weeks.
Yes, and here the fan takes up about the left third of the shot. But again, you're shooting the fan from behind, so you can also see the face of the person being cooled by the fan. They're very cool.
Thank you.
And you also told us that the kinds of photos that you're taking on day one of a heat wave are very different from day three. I guess that relates to what you said a minute ago about how the medical emergency progresses.
Yeah, on the first day, it's people just enjoying themselves, cooling off slightly, you know, being in that sidewalk pool, being sprayed on the sidewalk, going to the pool, going to the beach. You know, what do we do? The human reaction to heat. And those are more fun. They're lighter photos generally.
So do you have any tips for people taking photos of heat, interesting things to look for, other advice for where to head or what kinds of angles to explore, not to exceed your competition, of course?
Well, absolutely. First off, I'd say it doesn't matter what camera you use. Plenty of great photographers are using iPhones. Look.
You got to get pretty close, though.
Well, you do, but getting close is good. You have to be close to take good photographs. And I'd look for life. And don't just, you know, walk by, take a quick snap. You have to work it. Take several photographs. Take a moment to compose. Your strongest compositional tools are your feet. You can move left. You can move right. You can go closer. You can kneel down. And there's, you know, again, there's plenty of people taking great street photos with smartphones. For example, Ruddy Roy or Ben Lowy or Carlos Ortiz. But I think the main thing is to be purposeful, to think exactly about what you're putting in that square frame and think that you control that. It's like a blank canvas, and it's a series of decisions that'll make this photograph. So you have to go out and find things and then make those decisions.
I like the one that's the next one in the sequence, which is a pretty dark shot of a guy on the 14th Street platform at the Lexington Avenue subway station, 14th and Lex. I guess that would be Union Square, wouldn't it? where you wrote that some passengers boarded the trains just to feel the air conditioning. And here's a guy waiting for a train. He obviously can't wait for this train to come, and he's wiping the sweat off of his brow. And, as people used to use movie theaters, subway cars as cooling centers.
Which is so strange, because I remember going down to subways to photograph how people are suffering. that was always a wonderful thing, a subway car or a subway station.
Well, and what a duality. Because
but it was wonderful for the photographer.
Right. And what a duality, because the platforms can still be some of the hottest spots in the city as you're waiting for that over-air-conditioned train.
Absolutely. But, you know, I got to tell you, I really enjoy getting into the subway cars now when it's hot.
Is it possible to still take an interesting photo of someone in a fire hydrant stream?
Wow, that's a little hard, to be honest. It is possible. The challenge is to take photos that don't look like the million other photos of that. It's the classic, the well-worn cliche. It's the easiest thing to go out and do. So you can take an interesting photograph of everything, anything at all. So I think it's possible, but you have to work hard. But, you know,
The one like that, I just want to point out to people that the one like that, which is the second to last in the sequence on our site, which is the example we have of a fire hydrant spray, James Estrin shot. It looks like you worked hard by waiting until the nighttime, for one thing, because this is a nighttime shot, and the street looks pretty flooded, and you've got the, some glow from street lights there and some glow from building lights and reflections off the water. So you've got a lot of stuff going on other than a spray and kids in bathing suits.
Well, you know, the whole key to photographing is to be out there. You have to spend the time. You have to, in my case, it's drive around. You have to be out there to find things that are interesting happening. This was late at night. I took one last drive through after spending all day and having sent in photographs. And it was different. You know, I shot it, and it was very hot still. And it was something I hadn't photographed before. So this time, these hydrants were okay for me.
Can cameras pick up heat waves at all, or is that too visually subtle?
Actually, with a very long lens, with very, very hot pavement, at times it can pick it up. But I don't think that you need that necessarily to show heat. I think that there are many different ways of showing heat. And beyond that and beyond the fried egg on the sidewalk, I think it's how...
You say you would get that with a long lens? Like shooting a long lens, you would, you know, to shoot something close up from a distance?
Yes. It compresses, and so there are situations where you can find that. But, you know, in all my years, I've never made a good photo of that. It doesn't happen commonly.
Oh, and I like the shot from Orchard Beach or at Orchard Beach in the sequence that we have up of your stuff. The dateline was July 16th, 2006, caption: on a very hot day at Orchard Beach, William Harrison and his fiancée Gloria Marr sat in the water to keep cold. But what people will only realize if they stop to think about it is that you went out in the water. You must have been up to your waist in order to take the shot looking back at people toward the beach.
I was indeed, and I didn't have shorts on. I remember I had long pants on, and I just took off my shoes and went out there because it was a photo that needed taking. First, I photographed from the rear, and then I photographed from the front, and, you know, it was a New York slice of life that I just had to capture.
James Estrin does the wonderful lens blog for the New York Times. Thanks a lot for talking about your heat shots.
My pleasure, Brian.
From this mess that we made, it's too hot, lady. Gotta run for shelter, gotta run for shade. It's too hot.